This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're playing a collection of conversations that we've had over the year. Today's theme is books, from author interviews to the publishing industry to books on film. We kick things off with Harvard's famed constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe about his new book on the Roberts Court. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She is Marjorie Egan. Guns, race, religion, freedom of speech, money, access to health care. These are issues that define what it means to be an American. Issues that take on a very different meaning and power depending on where the law comes down on them. For nearly a decade, as you know, Chief Justice John Roberts has led the highest court in the nation. Under his leadership, the U.S. Supreme Court has had a conservative majority that has challenged the president and Congress quite often. But apart from a highlight reel of landmark decisions such as Citizens United, the Affordable Care Act, DOMA, what do we know about the motivations of the nine men and women who make up the Supreme Court, and how are they redefining democracy and the Constitution? These are just some of the questions that Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe takes on in his new book. It's called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. Larry Tribe, it's great to see you.
Great to be here, Jim.
Well, I said this off the air, but I'll repeat it now because I am the non-lawyer in the room. This is very accessible to people. I mean, this is heavy-duty stuff in many ways, and you make it very easy to understand, which for me is very important, making it easy to understand. So in any case, you talk about motivations. You also talk about the different perspectives that these nine justices have on what the Constitution means by equal protection under the laws, you know, desegregation, affirmative action, same-sex marriage and stuff, and voting rights. How did this different perspective manifest itself in the most recent voting rights, where they took away part of the Voting Rights Act?
Well, I think that in the Shelby County case, when they kind of demolished the pivotal piece of the Voting Rights Act, the one that required counties and states that had a history of racial discrimination to get pre-clearance. In that case, the court was deeply divided between two completely different worldviews. There was the worldview of those four justices, including the Chief Justice Roberts, a former student of mine, who I say that in as neutral a way as I can. He was very bright. But their view seems to be that we are pretty much at the promised land in terms of race, and that because we solved our main problems, we can put away the tools. It's a view that I think was powerfully criticized by Justice Ruth Ginsburg in dissent when she said it's like saying that if you're in a rainstorm and the umbrella has kept you dry, it's time to throw away the umbrella. I think it wasn't very logical. The other justices have the view that we have miles to go before we sleep, that we can't simply shut our eyes, blind ourselves to racial realities. And then there's Kennedy in the middle, who's pivotal on these issues.
And when you say preclearance, it means the Justice Department had to approve any changes prior to them being
implemented. Right, and they could take them to court in advance.
How weird is it to see your students sitting in the I wasn't going to mention this till later, but since you mentioned that your Roberts was in your class, Justice Roberts, Barack Obama. How weird is that
for
you?
And Elena Kagan. Don't forget Elena.
How strange is that for you?
It's totally weird. It's I have to say, it. You know, the usual phrase is it's humbling, but it's true. I mean, I think about a career of over 40 years of teaching, and I've had amazing luck with the students who've chosen my class. Students who've been my research assistants, they've changed the world, not always necessarily for the better, but it's like having sort of a fleet of really smart kids. And they go out there and they do stuff. It's pretty weird.
You know, it's like, can we stay on right?
I wonder if you can handicap them. If you saw, you know, Elena Kagan sitting there, or you saw Robert sitting there and thought, this is the future justice. Has that ever happened?
It's a little too self-congratulatory to say that. But I certainly told people when Barack Obama was my research assistant that this was a guy with an unlimited future. And I felt that way about Elena, very different.
Yeah.
But I knew at the time that these were amazing people. I had no idea how far they would go. And I'm pleased and proud of how far they went.
Let me be clear. I was not in Larry Tribe's law school class,
Jim.
Just in case anyone was wondering. Can we stay on race for a minute, Larry Tribe? The Michigan decision about declaring that race-conscious criteria for things like education, employment, that sort of thing. What struck me is Stephen Breyer, a Cambridge kid, ends up being the
fifth vote. Well, a San Francisco kid, really.
Well, but it lives in Cambridge now.
Yeah, he does.
Okay,
so. But I grew up with him. on the West Coast.
You did? Is that
yeah,
so?
Yeah, yeah.
So Steve Breyer joins the I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, joins the conservative majority basically to say the people spoke. There was a ballot question, the people spoke. In that case, we'll allow them to vote down these race-conscious criteria. What sticks with me about this, I have a bee in my bonnet and then some about Clarence Thomas, who I am convinced, and based on what I read in your book, that you clearly don't agree, doesn't speak because most of the time he doesn't know what's going on.
I know you don't agree.
So I'm going to get.
Right, okay.
But the thing that really drives me nuts about Thomas, and you can disabuse me of this too, even though I didn't like what Breyer did in this case, Breyer voted out of type. Like, you know, he's a liberal. Mm-hmm. You expect him to be on the other side in this. Has Clarence Thomas, in all of his years on the Supreme Court, ever once voted out of type? Or could you not predict? And you could write his decisions
not even before their arguments, can't you?
Not
quite. But an answer to your question, yesterday he voted out of type.
Oh, what was that?
That was a case where Elena Kagan led the court in a 5-4 decision ruling against immigrant children who had the bad luck to turn 21 before their parents, who had green cards, got to the head of the slow-moving waiting line for an immigrant visa. Her opinion was joined by Tony Kennedy and Ruth Ginsburg. Her conclusion was supported in a separate opinion by Roberts, joined by Scalia. But the dissenting justices who ruled in favor of the boy who had turned 21 after his mom, who had come here from El Salvador in 1998 and had waited in line for 8 years, were unlikely bedfellows. Alito, Breyer, Sotomayor, and guess who? Clarence Thomas.
Is that a first?
No. There are other cases where Clarence Thomas does not do the predictable thing. It's true that on race cases, both he and Sotomayor have powerfully firm views based on their own experiences. And their experiences have taught them different lessons. She was taught the lesson that without a leg up, a lot of brilliant minorities just won't make it. He was taught the lesson that with a leg up from the whites in power, a lot of brilliant minorities will never be given credit for their full accomplishments.
But when you read, you wrote this, that when you see him comparing liberal integrationists in the 21st century with Jim Crow segregationists.
It's terrible. And it's terrible when Roberts does that. I think they're deeply misguided. But, you know, preaching to the choir and simply repeating that I think that the liberals are more right than the conservatives on issues of race isn't going to do any good. I think what people need to do is to understand the point of view of the people they don't think they agree with, mm-hmm. and sort of see where it's all going.
We're talking with Lawrence Tribe, whose new book is Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. But you talk about, and I found this fascinating, Justice Thomas' attitudes about race and affirmative action. He has a line there. I think it's, beware of elites bearing racial theories. This is Justice Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that resonated with me, too, when he talked about busing in South Boston. What did he say about busing
in South
Boston?
Yeah, he said he wouldn't have himself risked going there, and to make kids go there as a kind of token, a way of getting past race, seemed to him to be a way of sort of using people to appease liberal guilt. And it wasn't really what minorities need. What they need is self-empowerment. He was a little more Malcolm X.
Yeah.
In that respect, than Martin Luther King.
And you have been here in Cambridge for many years. I mean, there was the elites from Wellesley and the rich people from Boston,
right,
who weren't going to send their kids to the public schools. You know, they basically mixed poor South Boston and poor Roxbury. It was elites thrusting their views.
It was elites. And when the Supreme Court did various things in favor of integration, it stopped short of requiring cross-town busing and really exacerbated the flight of rich whites to the suburbs. And we've got a problem that we certainly haven't solved in all the years since Brown v. Board of Education.
And one more thing on this affirmative action thing, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, second woman, right, on the Supreme
right,
Court after
right.
Senator O'Connor.
Senator O'Connor was the
but
first.
But she readily says, yeah, I'm an affirmative action baby. I mean, her attitude is totally different. What do you
right,
make of
as
that?
As is Sotomayor's.
Yes.
Well, I think the people are different, and that's why what we need to figure out when someone is nominated for the court in the confirmation process is not just how cleverly they can throw off certain lines, but where their heart is on a lot of these issues that are fundamentally emotional in content. It's not a logic machine. We don't have 9 robots. If that was what we had, we could do with one well enough programmed. And what I make of that is that we can never expect people to come to the court if they are human beings with views, and if they're not, they don't belong there. We can never expect them to be purely neutral and purely objective. And for them to give their philosophy room to influence their decisions is not inappropriate.
We're talking to Lawrence Tribe, obviously Harvard Law professor extraordinaire. You spoke about confirmation hearings. You spoke about Brown versus Board of Education. Just to give people a taste of Justice Roberts, here he is talking about Brown versus Board of Education and how the Supreme Court was forced to act when no other governing body would. Listen.
The other branches in society were not addressing the problems of segregation in the schools. They were not just slow to act, they weren't acting. But that didn't mean the courts should step in and act. But when the courts were presented with a case that presented the challenge, this segregation violates the Equal Protection Clause, the courts did have the obligation to decide that case and resolve it. And in the course of doing that, of course, change the course of American history.
That's Justice Roberts, well, then not soon to be Chief Justice Roberts at his 2005 confirmation hearing. Larry Tribe, can I ask you a couple of things about cases in the past from this court and whether or not they're prelude to the future? We talk a lot about guns on this show. Was it the Heller? Is that what the
Heller
the,
and then McDonald? Right.
Was it Heller? Was the case was the first case to establish mm-hmm. that an individual under the Second Amendment had a right to
right,
bear
and
arms?
And it was not limited to the militia.
And was that 5-4?
It was 5-4.
How strong? Assuming that a conservative justice were to retire or die, and a Democratic president were picked to pick a moderate to liberal, is that the kind of case that could go the other way on the Second Amendment, or is the political divide so deep that they wouldn't tread in that area?
Well, I think the political divide is very deep, which accounts for why the court has remarkably declined to take another step in that area. Lower courts are completely divided over what the court's decisions mean. They're divided over whether the right to bear arms is limited to your home or whether you've got that right when you go outside and may need just as much to protect yourself. And I think that the court probably recognizes that the political forces that affect whether we will have the kinds of gun regulation that its own decisions say are perfectly fine under the Second Amendment are so deep that for it to take further steps may not make a huge difference. Will stir up the hornet's nest, but may not really change the direction of history.
What do you think the Second Amendment, the framers, the drafters, what do you think they intended in terms of individuals?
In terms of what they intended, it's a lot like what Alito said when he was making fun of Scalia in one of the arguments. He said, I think what Justice Scalia wants to know is what James Madison thought of video tapes. We don't know what...
Bad question on my part, okay.
But I think that the public meaning of the Second Amendment was a meaning connected to the militia, but at a time when the militia meant every able-bodied male, and it was only males who were armed. I think that there is a lot to be said historically on both sides of that issue, and the idea of self-defense as a basic human right, something we importantly protected on the part of former slaves when we enacted the 14th Amendment, is pretty serious.
That we're talking to Larry Tribe. His latest book is called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. One more prior case and what it means for the future. After the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act decision overturning it, basically, and DOMA, I'm sure everybody knows, the decision that said for purposes of federal laws and federal benefits, defense of marriage is defined as between heterosexuals. Virtually everybody who sits in your chair here, including some people who oppose gay marriage, have said it's only a matter of time. There is a point at which the U.S. Supreme Court, whether it's this one or the next one, is going to say the U.S. Constitution bans discrimination against people as to who they want to marry. Is that coming?
I think it's coming. It's coming in 2015, maybe 2016.
Really? Wow.
On a lot of issues, I take a kind of, against the grain view. I don't agree with everybody. But on this one, I think that that it is only a matter of time. The handwriting is on the wall, and the handwriting says that for the government to tell people whom to love and whom they can marry is not an appropriate role for the government. It denies equality, liberty, and dignity for a group of citizens.
One last thing about this. I know Marjorie wants to take you in another direction. As humans, not as justices, and I know that theoretically that is not a separate kind of thing, but as human beings, does a John Roberts, who is as smart I'm sure, as you say is, and everybody I've ever read write about him say is, does he say to himself, I know right now we're not going there, but when I leave, I'm 59 or 60, whatever he is, I'm going to be here another 15 years. I don't want to be on the wrong side of history on this issue. So at some point, whether Tribe is right and it's 14 or 15 or 16, or whether it's 20, do they say to themselves, before I get out of here, I want to make sure I'm in the right spot on this thing?
I don't think they say it so self-consciously, because there's a tension between focusing on your legacy that way and telling yourself, as all of them do, I'm going to do my damnedest to understand this Constitution the way I think it really was intended. They all think that. Whether they call themselves originalists or not, mm-hmm. they think that this is not a document that's like putty in their hands. So I think some of them are more candid with themselves than others. I think some, you know, if Kennedy were psychoanalyzed, I'm sure that the shrink would end up saying he really believes that his long-term legacy is going to be to do for gay rights what Brown v. Board did for race.
And he wrote the DOMA decision.
He wrote
he not?
The DOMA decision yeah. in every major decision of this court that favored equality for gays.
We're talking with Lawrence Tribe, whose new book is Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. Jim Browdy and I are fairly obsessed with the issue of cameras in the courtroom, in the federal mm-hmm. courts, because they're already in the state
so
courts.
So glad you're bringing this
and
up.
And the Whitey Bulger case, everybody missed that, unless you could get to the courtroom, and very few people could get into the courtroom. The Tsarnaev trial, if there is a trial, there may not be one, but if there is one, it's going to be the same thing again. This time right. we're talking about hundreds of survivors of the marathon effectively being barred from seeing the trial because there's no room and even the overflow courtroom, et cetera. You can't see it on television, is the point I'm getting to. You have this whole section about the justices talking about, I was kind of surprised by some of these remarks, Sotomayor saying that, well, few will understand what the process is if there were cameras in their courtroom. And Scalia says it will misinform the public. And Kennedy, you know, says it's going to be too many sound bites. And Clarence Thomas is worried about his privacy. I guess he goes off in RVs to Walmarts and during the
poll. And Justice Souter, you know, relished not being recognized when he
That's
walked
right.
around in New Hampshire.
That's yeah. right. But what do you think?
I think that there ought to be cameras in every courtroom that decides matters of importance to the whole public, and that certainly includes the Supreme Court. The very first case I argued and won in the Supreme Court was a case about the right of the press and the public to observe and report criminal trials. And it's not limited to criminal trials. When the Supreme Court decides a case like Brown v. Board or DOMA, or cases about affirmative action.
Yes.
It's affecting all of our lives. The idea that the justices have some prerogative to remain anonymous when they are dispensing with our lives is ludicrous. And I think that, too, is only a matter of time.
You
but
do.
That may take longer.
You just predicted 2015, 2016
well, for I, you know, if I had to make a guess, I think 2020.
Wow. Why? Why will it happen?
Because, first of all, Congress is very reluctant to tamper with the court's rules. It's a coordinate institution of government. And the justices have their own privacy to worry about. In fact, sometimes that helps us. I mean, when the GPS came before the court, Roberts asked the government attorney, do you really mean that they could stick a GPS under all of our cars and follow us for a month without a warrant? And the poor representative of the Obama administration, realizing that he had no possible answer, he had to say, yep, and it was over.
Okay.
We're talking to Larry Tribe, whose latest book is Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. And it is totally, when you read it, as Marjorie said at the top, it is totally accessible to lawyers and non-lawyers
great
alike.
Stories.
A couple of quick things. A feminist friend of both Marjorie's and mine, who I think you know, who wants to remain unidentified, says, please ask Professor Tribe, under equal protection, gender is not given the same status as race. One, is that a fair assessment of the Equal Protection Clause? And two, when and why does that change?
It is a fair assessment. The Supreme Court has said that when the government draws lines based on gender, it needs what they call an exceedingly compelling justification, but not quite as strong a justification as it might need for race. I guess the difference is that there are so many areas where women and men biologically differ, so that the court recognizes it's in some ways a more complicated issue. But the court has been quite blind to gender, even within that rubric. I mean, it has said that a law denying benefits to pregnant persons is not a case of gender discrimination because there are women and men on the non-pregnant side of that line. I mean, that's ridiculous. I think the court needs to be more sensitive to implicit discriminations against women, ones that are justified by unreasonable focus on biological difference. But I don't think it's ever going to be treated exactly the same way as race is, and lots of feminists don't think it should.
You know, Larry Tribe, Marjorie mentioned one of our obsessions is no cameras in federal courtrooms. Another obsession of mine, which I don't think she shares, John Roberts is 59 years old. He appears to be a healthy person. If he serves as long as the Stevenses of the world or the Ginsburgs of the world, he could serve through as many as 6 more presidents, maybe 7. Is there an argument to make that lifelong tenure is just a mistake? I mean, the reality is, even though we all talk about the rhetoric in presidential elections, probably the most important decision a president, maybe other than going to war, makes when he or maybe she. But people don't take that into account for the most. These people are the most important and powerful people in America. And once they're confirmed, they are there
for life,
forever.
And when the framers of the Constitution put that in place, the average lifespan was way less than it is now.
Wonderful point.
A lot of people make the point that it would preserve the independence of judges, not, you know, keep them from being dependent on political benefactors, if we had non-renewable 18-year terms and staggered them so that every president had roughly 2 appointments to make.
So how do you feel about that?
I think it's probably a good idea. I think it's really hard, as it should be, to amend the Constitution, and that's probably what that would take, although there are some ingenious workarounds about the current Constitution that say Congress might be able to set that up. But I think it's a good idea. I think right now presidents can project their philosophy too far into the future and too arbitrarily.
Well, Lawrence Tribe, every time there's a vacancy in the court, particularly if it's a Democratic president, the name of Lawrence Tribe comes up at the top of the list. Would you want it if it happened?
And I'm a little old now. I'm 72. I wanted it at one point. I thought it would be great. But I think in hindsight, I've been able to do a lot with my life without being in the position of dissenting from a lot of cases on the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Hey, Lawrence Tribe, speaking of the Supreme, you've given us a couple of predictions in terms of things like gay rights and guns, whatever. Some of the big cases on the horizon, we only have a couple of minutes, on the horizon from do you need a warrant to search a cell phone? In Massachusetts, the buffer zone issue is coming up. The Hobby Lobby case about religious can you get a religious exemption to some of the mandates of the Affordable Care Act if you have allegedly a heartfelt religious. Pick any of them. Well, Massachusetts might be interesting. Where's this buffer zone thing going?
Well, that's a terribly tough one. I mean, that involves a deep conflict of values. On the one hand, there is the freedom of speech of people who sincerely believe that what a woman is about to do involves a kind of infanticide. Mm-hmm. They, you know, some people think that's misguided, but that's what they believe, and they don't want to have to shout from 50 feet away. They want to be able to come up and, as they see it, advise women that they're making a mistake. On the other hand, women are already sufficiently traumatized by the procedure they're about to undergo. It's, for many of them, a very tragic choice. Giving them a kind of zone of solitude while they seek this reproductive health care to which they are entitled makes a lot of sense. So the court is going to be closely divided. It's likely that the court will draw some fine lines about what sort of buffer zone is allowed. I don't think it's going to say that the First Amendment just goes out the window because reproductive choice is involved, and it's not going to say that the right to abortion goes out the window because free speech is involved.
So how does that come down? Obviously 5-4, but what do they do?
I think 5-4 against Coakley, but I wouldn't bet my life on it.
So we only have 30 seconds left. Just tell me, and this is a personally selfish thing, that they're going to require a warrant for a cell phone search. If not, I will both lose my job and probably go to jail. So tell me they're going to require a warrant for a cell phone
search.
I hope
they will, especially for a smartphone.
Okay, you know? That's fine, and that's what I've got.
Well, you just told us how horrified Roberts was about the GPS thing, so maybe it will transfer
to
cell
maybe
phones as well.
Maybe it will work its way.
We were speaking with Lawrence Tribe. He's the Carl M. Loeb University Professor and Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard. His new book is Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. Up next, we talk to Temple Grandin about her latest book on autism and what it means to have your brain hardwired differently. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're playing some of our favorite author interviews. Last year, Temple Grandin dropped in to talk about her latest book. Temple Grandin, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Well, it's great to be here.
Great to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. So we can talk about humane treatment for animals in just a second, but I was hoping we could start with autism. You talk in your book about how you were born in 1947 when autism was really not well known and not well diagnosed. Now we're up to like 1 in 88 or 1 in 90, depending on whom you listen to, and mostly boys. So what is going on?
Well, I think a lot of it's increased detection. Over the decades, they've loosened up the definition. You know, back in before the early 90s, you had to have speech delay to be autistic.
Yeah.
Then they changed it to Asperger's, where you could have no speech delay. Now they're changing it again and to tighten it up some. There's no black and white dividing line between geeks and nerds and a little bit autistic. And radio station wouldn't even be able to stay on the air if it didn't have people with a little bit of autism spectrum to keep all the electronics going.
You know, Temple.
That's a very good point.
Piggybacking what Marjorie said, my understanding of something you write or spoke, it was 4 years before you were born was the first time autism was diagnosed.
Right.
So it's 70 years later, give or take a few here. Do the American people get it? Do we understand autism? Do we know what it means? Is it still scary to some people? Where are we in public understanding?
Well, the thing is, autism is a continuous trait. You know, your brain can either be made more thinking or a brain can be made more social. And, you know, a little less social, maybe a little more thinking. I mean, part of that's just normal human variation. Then you get into very severe autism where the child remains nonverbal. And is going to have to live in a supervised living situation. Very big spectrum. It's a developmental disorder, and it's got a largely genetic basis.
And you think, speaking of people across that whole spectrum, you've spoken out repeatedly about what you believe parents of young autistic kids should be doing to give them the best chance to live meaningful lives. What is your advice to parents?
Well, I had no speech when I was 2.5 years old, and I got really good early speech therapy. That's just essential. Then you got the kid that's kind of just awkward socially, no friends when he's in fifth or sixth grade, getting bullied and teased. He gets a label. And I get worried about some of those kids getting pampered a bit too much and not getting stretched to do different things. I'm seeing some of these kids that don't know how to go into restaurants and order food. They don't know how to shake hands. My mother had a very good idea of how to just push me. Like originally when I was 15, I didn't want to go to my aunt's ranch. I was scared. She gave me a choice, 1 week or all summer. And you know what? I ended up staying all summer and I loved it.
Well, you talk about, too, that you were only allowed to do the twirling games or the turning around games and stuff for a certain amount of time a day because your mother was very into you were going to do everything your siblings did.
Well, I was allowed to, like, do twirling and stuff for an hour after lunch. The rest of the time I had to be coming to meals. And,
yep.
And we've got to be teaching these kids social skills. It starts when they're really young with turn-taking games. When I was 8, I had to shake hands with my mother's dinner guests and serve them hors d'oeuvres. And that taught important social skills. Another big thing I'm concerned about is they're not learning work skills. And
yeah.
I learned lots of work skills. When I was 13, my mother got me set up to do a little sewing job 2 afternoons a week. When I was 15, I was cleaning horse stalls out. I was painting signs, shingling the barn roof. Learning sort of the discipline of doing work.
So how did your mother get it? I mean, obviously she understood what the right thing was, what just by feel. It isn't like at that point people were giving advice like you're giving in 2013. How did she decide that that was the best way to raise Temple Grandin?
Well, she had a really good sense, but I also think it was just old-fashioned 50s way of doing things.
Mm. But, you know, you mentioned before that there's a wide spectrum, and there are a lot of kids who have autism who can't talk at all, and they can't, you know, they can't, they're 6 and 7 and 10 and 12, and they're not able to even shower themselves or go to the bathroom themselves. So there's this huge other difficulty
right
there. And you mentioned before that you think it's mostly genetic-based. So you are not a believer in the, I thought you had a little vaccine thing going on
well,
there, too.
Well, that thing gets a controversial. I don't want to discuss it because it interferes with all the other things that
okay.
I care about discussing, like developing the kids' strengths. My ability in art was always encouraged. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I talk about the different kind of ways that people think. People on the spectrum tend to be good at one thing, bad at something else. I'm a visual thinker who's good in art.
What are you bad at?
Oh, algebra. Totally hit the wall at algebra. Couldn't do algebra. And the kids that can't do algebra, let's skip them to geometry.
Yeah.
And then you got the mathematics kids that have trouble with reading. And, you know, if that kid can do a, if that sixth grader can do a college math book, let them have a college math book. Work on building up the area of strength where they've
You talk about details that many people that have autism are incredible with details. Like what?
Well, details help me in my work with cattle because I was one of the first people to notice that when the cattle were going up a chute, they were scared of little reflections. They were scared of puddles, a rope hanging across a chute, a chain hanging down. And you know what? Most people don't see those things. I have to teach my livestock students, pay attention to detail. And we just did a lab last month for my class, and I deliberately put a chain swinging down in the chute, and I had 12 to 15 students come in, and only two of them saw it when I asked.
Hey, before I want to stay on this humane slaughterhouse thing that you've become legendary on. Before I do that, every time I've ever seen, I've never met you in person, but I've seen your pictures all over the place, seen you on video. You always have these incredibly beautiful Western shirts. Where do you get? Do you get them from one place? Where do these? Where do they come from?
Well, now I'm getting them mostly as gifts. Now,
is that true?
Yeah,
people send them to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, they do them. And if they fit, I wear them.
Yeah, she'll get the same outfit on the red tie. The red tie is on the cover of your book, but it's a different shirt.
Okay, so the Humane Slaughterhouse, which is sort of your trademark in many ways, some people might say there's no such thing as a humane slaughterhouse. It's just more humane than currently. What do you say to those people?
Well, basically, we need to give the animal a decent life. I feel very strongly when we raise animals, we've got to give them a life worth living. Those cattle would have never have existed if we hadn't raised those cattle. And there is stress going into the slaughterhouse, but it's about the same amount of stress as the veterinary shoot. I've been collecting a lot of cortisol and stress data from just the veterinary shoot, where all they did was collect a blood sample, and slaughterhouse, and it's right in the same range. And I had to find out when I first started, they're scared of getting slaughtered. So I'd go over to the Swift plant, and then I'd go over to the feed yard, and they behaved the same way in both places. And they weren't trying to jump out of the chute at the Swift plant. That had a low enough fence where they could have gone boink, and they could have jumped out, but they don't. And if you get rid of the distractions, they walk right in. I do have a video you can look at on YouTube, Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin.
Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. So do you ever think of becoming a vegetarian? You're not a vegetarian, are you?
No, I'm not. I couldn't function on a vegan diet.
Neither could I.
If I don't have meat, I just get all lightheaded and terrible.
So let me ask you about the whole HBO movie. Claire Danes, of course, has become a big star in Homeland, and she played you in the series. Did you ever get to meet her? She was in the HBO movie.
I did. And she's a very serious actress, really cares about what she does. And I had lunch with her, and she videotaped a meeting. And then I gave her all the oldest old tapes I could find. I gave her 20-year-old tapes. And she played those and played those and played those to become me in the movie. She did a fantastic job.
Yeah, they got like 7 or 8 Emmy nominations. It was a fantastic
hit. Well, they got 7 Emmys.
7 Emmys. Excuse me.
Yep.
Excuse me. I thought it was just 7 Emmy nominations.
No.
So what is the message? I mean, you talked about the strengths of autism. You mentioned before the details. In your book, you talk about going into, I think it was the O'Hare Airport and looking at the ceiling at the international airport, comparing it to some ceiling someplace else. You were able to make those great associations.
Well, I'm a total associative thinker. All my thoughts are in pictures. And so in the work that I did on designing cattle facilities, I could test run this equipment in my head. I thought everybody could test run equipment in their head. And my mind works in a visual associational way. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I give an example of, a United Concourse B.
Yes, that's it.
And O'Hara, and it's got the glass curved
yes.
roof. Now, if I start going into the glass structure category in my brain, I'm seeing the Crystal Palace. I'm seeing the biosphere in Arizona. And I'm seeing the greenhouse at Colorado State. But maybe I go into the airport category in my mind, and then I'm seeing Snoopy at the Minneapolis airport, and then I'm seeing this old grungy American hangar at LaGuardia, and I'd really love to go exploring in there because I think there'd be, like, interesting old aviation stuff in there.
And what about your memory involving movies? Tell people about that.
Well, I can remember scenes from movies, but everything is visual. And if you ask me about a smell, I'll see my grandfather's fireplace before I smell the nice smell. Okay, if you want to understand how my associative mind works, why don't you give me some keywords, pretend I'm Google for images, and I'll tell you how I access information. And don't ask me something common like house or car or something I can see in this studio. Think of something creative to ask me.
Go ahead, Marjorie Egan. You're on the spot.
Okay. Let me see. Well, we're going to talk about the Great Gatsby in a little bit. Do you ever think of the Roaring Twenties and those great
parties?
Okay,
well, I'm seeing flappers.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing the gangsters with the Tommy gun at the Round magazine.
Oh, that's pretty good.
I'm seeing the ladies with the big hats. And
that's
now
pretty
I'm
good.
Seeing my Aunt Bella, who wore big, huge hats. So now I'm seeing her apartment that I used to go visit. We'd have Thanksgiving parties there at my aunt's apartment. Now I'm getting sort of into relatives, and now I'm going to my grandmother's apartment, and she had this wonderful toy wind-up squirrel I used to play with. See, and these things,
that's amazing.
These things are coming up like pictures.
That's amazing, and that's how your mind.
That's right.
And yet you said you're not that great with faces.
Well, yeah, I have the typical autism face recognition problem, recognizing emotional expressions. That's kind of the core deficit in autism. But you take out a few social circuits and you get geek circuits. I mean, Einstein didn't have any speech until age 3. He'd be labeled in a lot of school systems. You know,
yeah.
What would happen to little Albert today? How many drugs do they have little
Albert
on? How about little Steve Jobs Jr.? The weird loner who brought snakes to school and then he turned
That's
them
true.
Loose.
That's true. That's
and
true.
Temple, you know, I'm sorry. Go
you
ahead.
Know what saved Steve Jobs?
What?
It was the neighborhood computer club. Getting in with the other guys, doing a shared interest. That saved me in high school when I was being teased to death. Model rocket club and electronics lab, riding horses. Those are things I could do when I was not teased doing those
yeah.
activities.
Temple Grandin, your new book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. What does that add to, for people who've read all your work and have seen you and seen you speak, what does that add to what you brought to the whole autism discussion in America?
One major thing it adds is the history of the diagnosis. People get completely hung up on these labels. Well, every decade or so, the Psychiatric Association has been changing the labels. They're not precise. Also, I got a major chapter in there on how the, I've always talked about the visual thinkers and the mathematical thinkers. We actually, Richard Panik and I, and won the late night surfing session, dug up the research that shows that these two kinds of cognitive styles that I had just sort of figured out myself actually have got scientific research to back that up.
Wow. You know,
it also shows my really interesting brain scans and sort of my journey through all the brain scan things. But and then at the end of the book, it's got a big, long section on jobs. Yeah, you can find some of that stuff out
which
on the
is
Internet.
Great. Which
but
is
we
great.
Have got to work on the job thing. I am seeing too many smart kids on the spectrum, recluses, playing video games, 18, 22 years old, never learned any job skills.
Yeah.
You know, if there was a paper route when they were 12 years old, I'd put them on a paper route. And the paper routes are gone. Well, how about walk dogs every day for the neighbors? There's a discipline of work that these kids have got to learn.
Thank you so much for being here. Great book, great work with autism, great work with the humane. I feel bad for those cows going up that chute, too. I feel terrible.
Well, getting eaten alive by wolves would be a lot worse.
Temple Grandin is a doctor of animal science and an autism activist. Her latest book is The Autistic Brain, Helping Different Kinds of Minds Succeed. Coming up, New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chass joins us to talk about her new memoir. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're rebroadcasting some of our favorite author interviews, which includes our recent conversation with New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It's the moment we've all been waiting for, and we didn't even know we were waiting for it until it happened. And that is Roz Chast's take on aging and dying. Roz Chast, as you know, is a cartoonist for The New Yorker. Her new memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It details the aging and death of her parents. Roz, it is a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we have so enjoyed going through your book. So tell us essentially, we all know you're a cartoonist at The New Yorker, and this is a book of cartoons, but it talks about your parents getting older. Tell us what you've done here.
I hope, an interesting book. It was something I really wanted to do. It's a graphic memoir, but it's not a typical graphic memoir. It has a lot of cartoons in it. It has illustrations. It has text, although none of it is set in type. It's written in my own handwriting, and photographs, and then some non-cartoon type drawings at the end. So
Well, you have a lot of very funny stuff at the beginning of the book. Well, all through the book, actually. But at the beginning of the book, and you talk about, you know, your parents and how they got together and how they told you about their horrible lives and so forth that couldn't compete. You were so lucky. Your mother built like a fire hydrant and a peasant, and your father kind of spindly and stuff. But it's a relationship. You're dealing with – well, you talk about trying to talk to them about, you know, their plans.
The talk.
Yes, the talk. How did that go, the talk that you tried to have with your parents?
It didn't really go very well, but I have to say here that I was equally reluctant to have the talk. So we were all complicit in this avoidance of the topic. And I think, you know, why not? Because it is a terrible topic. It's an awful topic. Nobody really wants to talk about it. How do you know when you're ready to take the next step? And I didn't want to push them. I just thought maybe it would be a good idea at some point if we just sort of broached the topic, but it didn't go very well. The title of the book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, actually comes from something my father would say whenever this sort of topic would come up.
And by the way, we should put this in the context then, because I can relate to this as an only child. You're an only child.
Yes.
So,
right.
I mean, the burden falls even more heavily, even though your parents were in their 90s. So it wasn't like you're having a conversation with parents who are in their early 60s or
something like that.
It was clear it was on the horizon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This isn't something, I mean, I've talked to people in their 20s who say, my parents are like 68 or something. And I think, no, that's not what I'm talking about.
No.
That's not what I'm talking about.
You know, can you put this in? Let's talk about them for a minute before you talk about their end and how you dealt with this. One of the things that appealed to me particularly, I used to be a housing lawyer in the South Bronx, and I dealt with a lot of people who lived in so-called Collier's mansions.
Oh, yeah.
Your parents were pack rats.
Yes.
They collected and kept everything.
Right.
You photograph it, you draw about it, you write about it. Tell us a little bit about that.
My parents were both born in 1912. Depending on how you count, I always thought, I had heard when I was growing up, 10 days apart, but The New Yorker told me it's actually 11 days. So they were both born in 1912. They grew up as children of immigrants, very, very poor. Their parents didn't speak English. And they graduated from college in 1932, I think, into the Depression. And so there were a lot of factors, I think, that combined to make them, you know, almost pathologically frugal. You know, the consumption culture of the United States was something that was very foreign to them. And sometimes, you know, as I said in the book, there are aspects of it that I admired, that I thought were great. You know, you don't want to – I hate the idea of, you know, you have perfectly good silverware and then, like, let's just replace it because I'm bored, you know, and it's stupid. But
how about the potholder, though? I mean,
tell
us about the potholder that you drew
about.
Well,
that cartoon I did well before I ever thought about doing this book. I was visiting them. I was living in Connecticut with my family, and my parents were in Brooklyn. And I picked up this oven mitt, and it was so decrepit. It was not only – it was just like the most decrepit oven mitt that I had ever seen. It was like burnt in places, and then I realized it was patched. And it was like my mother sewed patches on an oven mitt. And then I realized that the patches of the oven mitt were made from a the fabric, I recognized it was a skirt that I had to make in seventh grade in home ec. And it was just, it was just too much.
We're talking to Roz Chass, the brilliant cartoonist. You've seen her stuff in The New Yorker forever, and she has a new book, which is huge and great. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And the topic that they're not talking about is dying.
Yeah, and for people that haven't seen the book yet, and you should get it because it's fantastic, this is all told with these great cartoons and great pictures of you and your parents with the great special facial expressions looking horrified or aghast, but dealing with something that is so universal. I mean, you talk about when your mother fell and refused to go to the hospital.
Yeah. My mother hated hospitals and, you know, with a somewhat good reason. A lot of old people do go to the hospital and then worse things happen. You know, not everybody. But she was afraid of that. She didn't want doctors. She fell off of a small step stool. And that was sort of the beginning of this more sort of precipitous decline. But what really was going on was not so much the fall off the ladder, which was bad enough, but that she also had diverticulosis, which sometimes flared up into diverticulitis. And she would have attacks of it, but in the past she was always able to sort of wait them out. But at that point, soon after the fall, she went into an attack that she wasn't able to fight off.
You know, I'm looking at one of your cartoons. It is hard to do through the radio, but there is this unbelievable drawing of your mother. And your mother says, hold on a minute while I look for it. This is obviously all for a collection. And then actually, do you mind reading? Perfect. Read your. This is okay. Roz Chass reading a cartoon about her having a phone conversation with her mother.
Well, it needs a little bit of background here because it also, in some weird way, I felt that I was at fault here because the reason she was on this stepladder was because I was telling her in that sort of weirdly braggy way that you do to your parents, even when you should be like well past this and much more mature. I was, for work, going with a friend of mine, she was going to write it, I was going to draw it, we were going to the Galapagos Islands. And in that sort of braggy, like, Mom, look what I am doing kind of way, I told her that I was going, and she said, oh, Daddy and I went to the Galapagos Islands about 30 years ago, and when we crossed the equator, we got a certificate from King Neptune, and I think it's up on top of the crazy closet. Now, the crazy closet was this closet in the middle of our apartment that sort of functioned as our attic, and it was just amazing, all of the crap that was in that closet. It was like every piece of falling apart cheap luggage they had ever had, an old Rexograph machine from my father's, you know, teaching days, stacks of unused, like, French and Spanish exams that he hadn't, like, given out, textbooks, and bathrobes, galoshes, pajamas, hats, everything you could think of, just crammed in there. And the idea of I think my mother was 93 at the time, the idea of her getting up on a step stool to find that stupid piece of paper was not something I wanted her to do. So, but she was extremely strong-willed and compulsive. So here's the cartoon. I'm talking to my mother on the phone. I've just told her about this. She's explained to me that she wants to go and get the certificate. And she goes, and this is my mother, hold on a minute while I look for it. And this is me. Mom, please do not look for it. I don't want it. Please do not climb to the top of the crazy closet. Promise me. And she just goes to the phone. She goes, and hangs up. You know,
with a great look on her face, by the way. It's almost a mischievous look, like, that's where I'm going. I am making a beeline to that crazy closet.
I'm doing it. You got another thing coming. If you think that your, like, strong words from up there in Connecticut will have any effect on my not climbing the step stool, you don't know me, Miss Chass.
I just want to say, this is the brilliance of your book, Roz, because, you know, people can write this, but you have the cartoons with the expressions and the images of your parents and yourself and sitting on these little couches. I mean, it just makes it perfect. It just makes it perfect.
Well, thanks.
Ultimately get them in a retirement home, and obviously, ultimately, and I don't mean this to be cavalier or quick, your parents die. But then where are your parents?
For the time being, my parents, I have no idea where my parents are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a whole other question. But their cremains, which is a really horrible word, are in my closet at home. I got them, I picked them up from the funeral home. And it's a very strange thing. I mean, you know, we don't have like a little spot on Cape Cod that we always, you know, called our own, where mother always said to me, you know,
When I die,
scatter my ashes on Granny's place. No, you know, we never had that in my family. We didn't talk about death. I did not know what to do with the cremains.
Sounds good to me.
Well, you know, Jim might be able to give you some advice on what to do with the cremains. Why don't you tell
my
Roz
mother
where
is
you are?
My mother's in a box in the back of my car, and she's been there for, I mean, she's relatively near me.
In the trunk.
And she didn't have a place either.
Do
she's
you
in the
like
trunk.
Driving around with her?
I don't think about it much. But occasionally, when I'm sorting through things, I find the box, and you say, your mother is in the back of your car.
See, I like having them in my closet.
Yeah.
Because I like my closet. And it's kind of, I don't mind having them there. And until I figure out a good place, like a place that makes sense, I don't mind. It seems less arbitrary than any other place I can
think of.
How do
you feel about you becoming a cartoonist?
You became a cartoonist? That's what I'm dying to know, because people know you from the New Yorker, Roz. How did you become, you know, what you are?
Beautifully put, actually. That sort
really
of says it.
Yeah.
I mean, were you good at drawing in school?
I always drew, and I always liked to write, and I liked making pictures that made me laugh, and I thought I found things funny, and sometimes even if I was drawing something seriously, it would come out sort of funny, and
And then you sent cartoons in? I mean, you've earned a living as a cartoonist. So you sent them to where, the New Yorker or other places first?
Well, I started out, I went to art school. I went to Rhode Island School of Design. And first I never thought I'd be able to make my living as a cartoonist, actually. I never really did. The first place that I really thought that I would wind up working was maybe the Village Voice. And that was, to me, the height of all, because Jules Pfeiffer worked for them. My parents subscribed to The New Yorker, so I knew The New Yorker used cartoons, but I didn't see my stuff as fitting in with them. And my dream was to work for The Village Voice, and I was selling them some cartoons. But I was also starting out, I was 23, and I thought I should probably, you know, I was selling some to the National Lampoon, I was selling to The Village Voice. There weren't, you know, tons and tons of markets, and I thought I should try The New Yorker. I mean, because there was The New Yorker and there was Playboy, and that was even less relatable to. I mean, I did try at one point to do Playboy cartoons at the behest of the woman who was the cartoon editor, whose name was Michelle Urey, and they came out like parodies of Playboy cartoons because I really, you know, they were like, I have bosoms. And, you know, I had no idea. It was like boss chasing secretary around desk and you have, look at your bosoms. And yes, I do have bosoms. I really had no idea like what kind of, you know, humor to find in this. But anyway, so I thought, okay, I'll get together. I'll find out when the New Yorker has, you know, their drop off day. And I called them up, and at that time, this was 1978, they took things on Wednesday, like over the transom things. So I put everything I had, about like 60 cartoons. I had no idea how to do this at all. And I didn't have anybody to ask. I just sort of thought, okay, I'll put the cartoons in this envelope, and I'll put my card in it, and then I'm sure they won't take anything, and I'll pick it up the next week, but I will have tried. I wasn't even like nervous because I was so sure that they weren't going to take anything.
How many before they took the first one?
They actually bought something from that group.
Wow. What did that feel like?
I was flabbergasted. I was just flabbergasted. And Lee Lorenz, who was the art director at the time, told me to start coming back to the to not just drop stuff off, but just to actually come in to the actual part of the magazine.
But haven't I – have I read somewhere that – we had Bob Mankoff in here a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about a whole bunch of people, including you. You've had, have you had 90 – something like 90 – we only have a minute left. Like roughly 90% of your cartoons have been rejected by The New Yorker?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, I mean there's – that's – but it's not me. I mean I probably do as well as anybody there. I'm sure there's people who have even
– Oh, he told us that. It was
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of that, in his book, and I know that this is my – you have a cartoon that I – this it's called Insomnia Jeopardy, and here are the categories. Ways in which people have wronged me. Strange noises, diseases I probably have, money troubles, what did I say, why did I say do that, and ideas for a screenplay. Can you relate to that, Marjorie Egan, or
totally.
Can you not relate
and
to
I
that?
Love the one about the everybody Velcroed to the wall.
The Velcro family. It's just unbelievable.
That's fantastic, too.
So, but answer my question before. We only have a minute. Oh. Were your parents okay with you being a cartoonist? Is that not like a real job for the family?
I think that they thought I would probably go into the family business, which was teaching. My mother was an assistant principal. My father was a French and Spanish teacher. And I think that they thought that eventually I would wind up doing that. So it was possibly as much of a surprise to them as it continues to be a surprise to me that I you know, thank God, because I can't teach.
It's not a surprise to us, Roz. Roz Chast's new book, Roz Chast, it's a memoir. Can't we talk about something more pleasant? It is just
It is an amazing book. Roz Chast is a cartoonist for The New Yorker. Her new memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Up next, it's a slightly different look at books with Harvard historian Nancy Kane and her take on the online bookstore turned retail giant, Amazon.com, and how it's changed the value of the book is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. For today, we've put together some of our favorite interviews. The focus is on books, from author interviews to the publishing industry. Earlier this year, Harvard historian Nancy Kane joined us to look at Amazon.com and how they're changing the value of the book. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am, what am I, Jim Browdy. That was really embarrassing. And she is Marjorie.
Welcome to my world, Jim.
I know who the woman in red here is. Joining us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is Nancy Kane. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about Amazon.com, and everybody knows it's great customer service and very convenient, and whether or not it's good for books. Great piece in The New Yorker about this from an issue a couple of issues ago. But I'm wanting to know, Nancy, before we start this whole thing, are they talking about, are we debating whether it's bad for books in terms of like sales or in terms of what money authors can make, or what are we talking about?
So this article is by George Packer, you know, a well-known American writer and surveyor of the national scene. I think his argument is kind of complicated. I think the gist of the piece, and it's relevant for our listenership, is, you know, is Amazon too big and too powerful for the social good? That's not a new question about companies, right? Remember the Microsoft debates of the late 1990s, or if you go farther back, the arguments about, you know, Standard Oil, which was broken up and then kind of reformed itself in the early 20th century, but reformed itself in the 20th. So this is, you know, I think the argument is about market power. It's about a power over other players on the landscape. So that part is curdles up little ideas or insights, little, you know, question marks about antitrust. It's an argument about, do you want distribution, content control, And even the, if you will, the pricing and form of books to be, which contain Packer and lots of other people have argued, you know, a whole cluster of often important, you know, game-changing ideas. Do you want a lot of power clustered around, you know, that at that kind of chokehold? I think that's a very interesting question in a democracy where we like to argue with good reason that the generation and flow of free generation and flow of ideas is very, very important to holding on to, you know, the fundamental motivation of democracy, you know, individual initiative and collective will.
You know, the subheadline in this piece is Amazon is good for customers. This is what Packer, or the headline writer, writes. But is it good for books? I assume before I read this thing, Nancy Kane, it was the same old fairly tired but important discussion about, well, they're going to put all booksellers out of business, particularly independent booksellers. But it's about books themselves, about authors themselves. Yeah. And Packer makes the contention that not only does Jeff Bezos, who significantly is now also the owner of the Washington Post, not only doesn't care about books at all, and frankly, never cared about books. That when he created this online bookstore that revolutionized the world, now called the Everything Store, I guess is the jargon, in 1994, it wasn't about selling books at all. It was about gathering data, he says, on wealthy or upper middle class and middle class consumers so he could sell them everything else.
Totally. The books were an entry point. There's very little historical debate about that, right? Smart hedge fund, former hedge fund, you know, staff,
30 years old.
30 years old, described by all kinds of people that knew him at the time as very, very smart, very driven, very ambitious. And he was very clear very early on that books, you know, made a lot of sense as an entry point, partly because they were dispersed, right, widely dispersed in terms of availability. So you could collect all these titles online and give people access to books they wouldn't otherwise have, and bookstore. And if they lived in a remote area, an effective bookstore. And they were away because
easy to ship and didn't break.
Very easy to ship, didn't break. There's not going to be quality control issues. Yep. It's not perishable, et cetera. All those things. Interestingly enough, I remember very early on talking to one of their early employees who was a graduate of the school, and her talking about how important it was that a lot of influencers from on both coasts and in the middle of the coast, in the center of the country, read books. So getting attention on this, he thought, would be good, you know, business model and business image building. He turned out to be very right about that. So it was clearly about a runway to what he saw very early on as the astounding growth and astounding potential of the internet, right? And it was going to gather information and build out the runway to what Brad Stone calls in his, you know, relatively new book, very good book on Amazon, the Everything Store. Interesting enough, last kind of historical tidbit that I learned in this article that I did not know before, the original or at least kind of working name of the business was Relentless. And supposedly the company still owns the URL to that. So I leave it to our listenership to go out and Google Relentless and see if you get taken to the Amazon website.
That's what he says. He says if you go to relentless.com, which I meant to do and I forgot.
And I have not done
that. If you go to relentless.com, you automatically are moved over to Amazon.
So that in itself tells you a little bit about, right, what this was about. Uh-huh. As opposed to, you know, creating the world's, you know, most reverential and convenient and accessible and largest bookstore.
Well, he gives us the opening paragraph of this, and it's so true, but you don't think of it. And when you see him write it all down, that Amazon is also a hardware manufacturer like Apple, a utility like Con Edison, a video distributor like Netflix, a publisher like Random House, production studio like Paramount, literary magazine, grocery deliverer. He goes on and on and on, talking about the UPS maybe having the things fly over. Now, what do you call those things? Going to fly?
Drones.
Drones. Yeah.
And P.S., let's remember the deal that Amazon's cut with the U.S. Postal Service, right, to deliver in certain places on Sunday. So they're also right now indirectly kind of feeding, right, revenue to the United States Post Office.
But he also says, and Ms. Harvard Business School over there, Nancy Kane, that it still struggles to stay in the black. How can that be?
So I did my usual numbers homework. So let me just give you a few of the numbers and I'll answer your question. So just to put it in perspective, they report on a calendar year. So last year, 2013, revenues were $74.5 billion. Their stock price as of yesterday, so I don't have it for today, was about $360, $359.82. And their market cap, the value of all those shares outstanding at $360, is 165 billion people. They employ somewhere between 84 and 110,000 people, depending on who you ask and how they're counting. And their net income on that $74.5 billion was $282 million. So that's just a small bit of that,
yes.
Right? It's one-fifth of 175th. So, and if you look at the income, the SEC filings, it's very sporadic. They had a lot of profit in fourth quarter, right, holiday sales. They have no profit in second quarter and third quarter. In fact, it's negative profits, which have to be offset, right, the positive profit in first and fourth quarter. So they still go in and out of the black. And the answer to how has to do with infrastructure build. So one of the fascinating things about Jeff Bezos is that he, like John Rockefeller, is building, and this has been true from the very beginning. This is why they didn't turn into the black much earlier, you know, after becoming a company and then becoming a public company in the late 90s. He's built his own warehouses. He's built his own, you know, astounding logistics and customer data collection facilities. When you call them a utility, or George Packer calls them a utility, he's talking about web hosting and web operation services that they sell to company institutions as diverse as the New York Times and the CIA, just to mention a few. So they have had to build, like Rockefeller, you know, ultimately owning exploration oil fields all the way down to Mobil and Exxon gas stations. They have had to build an enormous amount of the value chain, which they now own and control. So a huge amount of the money is not about paying enormous salaries to employees, or even I actually don't know their exact compensation landscape, but it's not primarily about returning it to shareholders or anything like that. It is about building infrastructure for a company that's relentless, and that, as Jeff Bezos still says, every day is day one.
So wait a second. So I would bet if we did a poll of people listening to this show, that a significant majority would agree with, let's say, Tom Menino from last year, and saying, we don't want a Walmart near us. Too big, too impersonal, too this. Why does everybody love to hate Walmart but loves to love Amazon?
So that's a great question, because when I first read this article, I actually talked about it in my class the next day, because what struck me in the Packer article, and there, Chelsea Mertz, one of your superstar staff members, sent me another interesting article from The Nation, right, admittedly, you know, of admitted political proclivities or sympathies, called The Amazon Effect, which is also very, very interesting. One of the things that struck me is how little we know about how big and tentacular, I use that word carefully, right, tentacular, tentacle-like, its reach is.
He hasn't disclosed anything. He doesn't have to, right,
Bezos? And the company is notoriously, like Apple, secretive. So I think, one, Americans don't know much about it. Now, there's beginning to be interesting little, if you will, slices and dices of some of the aspects of the company, like, you know, these lawsuits being brought around, you know, working conditions in some of their warehouses, right?
It sounds horrible.
Well, they sound pretty undesirable.
Like how fast,
right?
They have to move to get all
how
the
How fast they
there.
Have to move, you know, the security lines to get in and out that don't get paid for, that take 20 minutes, all kinds of stuff, right? The temperatures in them, which, you know, have since been remedied in some of these warehouses. Yeah, they have shades of what we read about Walmart, at least at certain moments in Walmart's history. So I think one of it is we don't know as much. Secondly, a whole range of the chattering classes are dedicated, right, in some cases, addicted users of Amazon, right? You know, they, you know, just one click. I need paper towels, right? I need a lock, a TSA tested lock, because I'm going abroad tomorrow. I hit my Prime membership. I think there are huge numbers of very, very influential people that use Amazon and depend on it now. And this is even before they start selling groceries and the range of things they're expecting
and
to roll.
And doing same day delivery.
And doing same day delivery in certain cities. So I think that's a piece of it as well. And I think a third piece of it is you have to step back now and really look at the reach of this company. It's much bigger reach than Apple. We don't think of it that way, but it's reach across industries, across players, across customer sets is just so broad and growing. And again, you have a leader and a team that is not relentless, that is not investing for tomorrow or the next day or even next year. They are investing for 2070, right? They are investing to build an enormously powerful entity that reaches around the world and uses the evolving power of the digital, not the internet revolution anymore, the digital revolution, to have extraordinary market power.
That's the voice of Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. So let me ask you two questions. One is the one we started with. What is Packer's thesis that leads him to ask the question, is Amazon.com good for books? And what's your answer to the question? Okay. And number two, the corollary question is, not only is Amazon good for books, but is Jeff Bezos good for newspapers? I mean, he bought the Washington Post, as people know, in a very celebrated purchase. So take either one.
Okay, so let me start with the first one. So I think what Packer winds his way to, it's a long article. It's got full of interesting data, so you know, yep, whether the thesis is as clearly advanced as it might be, right? There's lots of good things in there. What he winds his way to is the culture within Amazon as he can reconstruct it. Now, he's not there. Right? He doesn't live there. It's a secretive culture. People are very loyal to Amazon. I have a student of mine right now, he's a superstar, seems like a really great guy, and he's been there and he's going back, right? He thinks it's a very exciting place to be. So as best that Packer can reconstruct it, he says this is an anti-book culture. Like, they, you know, let's get books down to 99 cents, get them out on our Kindles, right? You know, and he uses this line, which I think perhaps is, may very well be unfair, but boy, is it powerful for those of us that read books for a living. You know, the book is like a sandwich. Let's figure out how to market it really cheap and get it out there. And so that's the first thing. Books are a commodity that is not necessarily very different than lots of things that are sold, and they don't demand, it demands care in consumer convenience and access, but the care of the content is not something that he perceives as being widely shared in the culture of the company. And he has lots of historical examples of how the culture has evolved from an editorial culture to now a culture driven by algorithms and data and slotting fees, right? Mm-hmm. Publishers pay big, big slotting fees, right, to get onto Amazon,
right,
and to stay on Amazon. They don't pay them. The buy button from their publications disappears. No publisher today can withstand that kind of, you know, twisting of the arm, if you will. So that's the first piece. The second piece is that there is something here. We talked about it briefly when we were talking about Silicon Valley several months ago. There is something here about technology, again, being the holy grail. Right, we've got the technology, we've got the algorithms, we have logistics that are powered by technology, we use the data, we have the Kindle readers. All is well in Gotham City, right, if we have that. And yet, if you talk to publishers, right, who a lot of tech people think of as, you know, the rotary phone, totally outdated, quaint, but absolutely adding very little value, they will tell you that great books written by people that are willing to take a chance on an idea or a plot or some kind of perspective, right, aren't things that are created by algorithms, right? They're created by the messy, messy alchemy of people who know how to think and know how to and have the discipline to put those thoughts on paper well and accessibly. And so Middlemarch, for example, never would have come to life if Jeff Bezos and his team had been doing their algorithms on it. No way, Jose. And so the second way that Packer argues that they're good for books is you can't really completely obsolete or even significantly obsolete the human appreciation and human judgment and human discernment and even the publisher's advance, which will quickly disappear in this race to the bottom in pricing, for people who can't otherwise afford to write. Because a lot of great writers didn't have a speaker's fee they could depend on to get their good books out. So, you know, it's a nested argument. It's an indirect argument. It's an interesting argument. But from what I experience as a sociologist and historian of what I feel is a naive and way under nuanced, not very deft embrace of technology as some kind of panacea substantively and structurally for our society, that piece rings very, very true to me.
So we only have a minute left. Okay. Is this bad news going to transfer to the newspaper
industry?
Well,
you know, so far, from what we know, again, indirectly, he's been very careful to say, I'm not going to mess with content.
Yeah, but so far, he was a bookseller in 1994. I mean,
and it looks like he's going to be a music seller, too, cutting into the Apple market as well.
Right, no,
that's their next plan.
No question. No question. So, you know, would I, you know, I don't know. I really don't know whether he's gonna, you know, play a strategic and relentless game with the Post. Newspapers do not serve the function that online or brick and mortar retailers serve. It's a very different function. It's enormously important, and we don't know. The jury's out.
We only have 30 seconds. You're right.
I wish Edward R. Murrow was sitting next to Jeff Bezos in the corner office in Seattle. Let's put it that way.
So, Marty Baron, former editor of the Globe, is sort of nearby.
Yeah,
before you go,
you're
writing a new book about leadership, which we'll talk about a lot. Could that book get published in the world that Packer describes?
oh, my book's, you know, I'm going to be in trouble in this world, right? But it doesn't, actually, I'm past caring.
All of the youths are going to be in trouble, isn't it?
Isn't that kind of a bulwark?
So unusual books have never started off ahead of the starting gate, right? Ever. Books that are unusual that have a different perspective, have different parts, never. There's the usual and the bestseller and the 50 Shades of Grey are going to be fine.
Can I tell you something? When your book comes out, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, Marjorie and I are going to stand up to Jeff Bezos on your behalf.
Okay.
Nancy Kane, thanks.
Nancy Pleasure. Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, a lot of emailers are big fans of yours. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Coming up next, film critic Darren Daly joins us to talk about books on film. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. We're on tape today, playing some of our favorite conversations with a focus on books. We continue with film critic Darren Daly and his take on how Hollywood turns books into both blockbusters and box office bombs. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. John Updike reportedly hated the film adaptation of his novel, The Witches of Eastwick. Harper Lee liked The Way to Kill a Mockingbird played out on the silver screen. In fact, she liked it enough to give Gregory Peck her father's pocket watch. No matter how writers, or for that matter readers, I guess, feel about seeing their beloved books on the big screen, novels have long fed the Tinseltown machine. Here with us in Studio 3 to look at this enduring relationship is film critic Garen Daly. Garen is the producer of the forthcoming film, The Orson Welles Complex. And in addition to talking to Garen, we want to talk to you. You can give us a call and tell us what film adaptions you love, what movie really got the book wrong at 877-301-8970. Hi, Garen.
Hi, guys.
Can I weigh in right away?
Sure.
Since you're the expert, and then you can critique my choices. Two best I could think of. Godfather, brilliant. Great book,
yep,
great movie.
Absolutely.
Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, two of the great book, great movie. The single worst adaptation ever is my favorite book of all time. It is really my favorite book. Here is a clip from Bonfire of the Vanities. Kim Cattrall tries to explain to a child what her husband, played by Tom Hanks, does for a living as a Wall Street investor. Listen to this.
Daddy passes somebody else's cake around and picks up all of the crumbs.
But you have to imagine a lot of crumbs and a great big golden cake and a lot of golden little crumbs. And you have to imagine Daddy running around picking up every little golden crumb he can get his hands on. And that's what Daddy does.
That almost ruined my life, Garen. I really, my favorite book ever. It was horrible, right?
This is a film that was done in the 90s. And it really brought in all the bad things from the 80s into it. And it was, you know, let's put together some big stars. And who cares about the plot? Because, you know, we've got Bruce Willis. We got Tom Hanks totally miscast as the bad guy. So and we all like him. So it's like we're conflicted there. And then you got Melanie Griffith playing this kind of ditzy, mistress. And it's like, nobody works in this film. And, you know, the author had to be really upset.
So Tom, I got it right.
I think you got it right. Yes,
you want to be judged, Marjorie? How about you? What are your choices?
Well, I was thinking when I was a kid how I read after seeing the movie Gone with the Wind, I read the book by Margaret Mitchell.
Right.
And her descriptions of the characters, it was as if she was describing Clark Gable as Rhett Butler. I mean, obviously the book preceded the movie, and it was exactly as she wrote in the book that they put it on the big screen. It was amazing.
Well, sometimes they do get it right, but it's not that often. The problem we have is they're two separate mediums. You have reading, which is all about imagination,
right,
and bringing it into your soul and into your heart. So it's very close to you versus something that you observe, which is a film, and somebody else's imagination that you're watching. So there's always going to be a conflict, and there's always going to be disappointment, especially when you have something that everyone loves, and somebody else takes it and turns it into something.
Now, I've got two movies I thought were better than the books.
Was better than the books?
Yes.
What are they?
Bridget Jones' Diary, which I absolutely adored. With what's her name? Who's the one that puckers her lips all the time?
Oh.
You know who I'm talking about.
Renee Zellweger.
Thank you, Renee Zellweger. Yeah, that book. And the absolutely horrible, sappy, drippy, purple prose, Bridges of Madison County, that was on the bestseller list for like 200 weeks.
Well, I said the movie was horrible, though, too.
The movie was pretty bad, but it was better than the book because it had Meryl Streep and Clint Eastwood in it. If people haven't seen it, you know, they're out, they fall in love in some Iowa farm and they run around and take pictures of bridges. But the book was so bad, and the movie was an improvement.
Well, you know, there are sometimes when they take a movie or take a book and they really improve on the book. For instance, there's Tristram Shandy would be one. That's an example of that. Adaptation would be another one.
Oh, yes. That was a great movie.
That was a great movie based on the Susan Orlean book, The Orchid Thief.
Yes.
And I think we have a clip of that.
Let's do this. In this clip from Adaption, neurotic screenwriter Charlie Kaufman, it's played by Nicolas Cage, who I often love, psychs himself out in a meeting. Listen.
She hates me. She's disappointed. I could see it in her eyes when we met. I've got to stop sweating. Oh, she looked at my hairline. She thinks I'm bald. She's thinking I would never in a million years sleep with this guy.
We think you're great.
Oh, thanks. Wow, that's nice to hear.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking to Garen Daly. We want to talk to you, too. What do you think is the best movie adaption of a book you really loved? And what do you think is the worst? How do they decide? What's the thought process? What are they looking for in a book? I don't know if you can generalize this.
Oh, yeah.
When the film people say, aha, this I can translate to the screen.
I think that's not really quite what they're saying.
What are they saying?
They're saying, how can I take this brand and sell it to lots of people? And really what you're talking about is you're taking a book that already has a built-in audience and reselling it as a movie. And so that brand awareness is really what Hollywood is talking about.
You mean even if it's not true to the source?
Even if it's not true to the source. And that's actually a big conversation going on in the industry. Back last winter at Sundance, they had a bunch of filmmakers talking about what it's like to take a book and turn it into a movie. And then this coming weekend down in Nantucket at the book festival, they have a bunch of authors talking about how their books are being taken and turned into movies. So you always have a conflict going on with that as well. And Hollywood really doesn't care. They're looking about selling tickets. That's all they care about.
Well, we've had a very successful local writer, Dennis Lehane, the mystery writer, who's had a lot of books turned into movies. You know, The Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone. And I mean, he's done quite well.
Yeah, there are some people who do quite well, and there are people who go through certain kind of phases. For instance, one of the top 10 writers who's had more works converted into films is a guy by Edgar Wallace.
Never heard of him.
I never heard of him either. But he wrote in the 1915s and the 1920s, and he wrote all these mystery novels, and they converted over very, very well to the film at that particular time.
Well, you know who's another local author who we've had in studio here? In fact, we asked him to recite by memory the name of his latest book, which was Endless, and he couldn't do it himself. Ben Mezrich. I mean, obviously, the Facebook movie, the movie about that little punk. What's the name of that movie?
Oh, Social Network.
Social Network. I mean, he's had some pretty
punk.
He's
done
well. I didn't say he hadn't done well. A little Zuckerberg guy just drives me crazy. Our number is 877-301-8970. You know, also, I'm not nearly the reader is than Marjorie is, but when I really Bonfire of the Vanities is a perfect example. I love this book so much. I literally wanted just to touch it. I was so nervous to go to the movies. I hadn't read any of the reviews, and I can remember the physical feeling, how upset I was. It wasn't just that it was not true to it, which is a piece of it, but it was just hard. I mean, it really hurts,
now,
you know?
On the other hand, Tom Wolfe also wrote The Right Stuff, which is a terrific book. It was about the astronauts.
I think that was a great movie.
And Philip Kaufman.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the movie, I think, worked really well because they had Sam Shepard starring in it, and they had the guy that played John Glenn was terrific.
Ed Harris.
They cast
Ed Harris
a great... So if people haven't read The Right Stuff, that's one of my favorite.
Well, again, what we have is you're talking about people who are smart enough to realize that you can't take 400 pages of book and convert it into 2 hours of movies without coming up with a different approach.
Yeah.
So what they use Carl Yeager, or the Yeager character.
Yes, Chuck Yeager.
Chuck Yeager. As the arc.
He was Sam Shepard.
He was the arc that held the thing together. That was a smart move.
He was so handsome.
Doesn't hurt. I was just going to say that he's one of the best-looking guys that ever walked the planet. Let's take a couple of calls on your favorite and least favorite adaptions of great books, at least books that meant a lot to you. Maggie, you're in Uxbridge. You're on with Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, and Garen Daly. Hi, Maggie.
My favorite book, Color Purple, and I actually enjoyed the movie, especially the ending, so much better.
Who starred in The Color Purple?
Whoopi Goldberg.
It was Whoopi Goldberg. That's what I thought. And that was good, too.
And that was
a good one, Maggie.
Production.
Thank you very much.
That's right, yeah.
Well, speaking of Spielberg, Carl just emailed in. He said, Jaws, not only the best movie ever, but the best movie from a really rotten book.
Another local guy, Peter Benchley. Isn't Benchley a local character? Isn't he a local guy?
Actually, we have a fair number of authors out of the Boston area or New England area. Nathaniel Filmbrook has a film coming up on Essex, which will be coming out sometime in 2015, which is the basis for Moby Dick, which is Herman Melville, which is another New Englander.
Wow.
Now, do they want that? When you decide to buy the rights to a book, I assume the rule of thumb is, if you're the movie makers, anything we can do to keep the author away from here is a good thing. Is that generally the approach, or is it not?
I think it really depends on the material you're talking about and what you intend to do with it. There are some films that you definitely don't want the
author. If you're not going to be true to the material?
Even if you are going to be true, because, you know, authors are authors. I mean, I have a quote from... Nat Segloff, an author who you may know, and he says that the adaptation should be what the reader remembers reading rather than what the author remembers writing.
That's a pretty good line.
And it is a good line.
Oh, that is a good line. Here's a good one. This is from Michael. Forrest Gump is a movie overshadowed and put to shame and buried the book. I don't even remember the book.
Nor do I. Tom Hanks again. Yeah.
That was one of the great ones to watch for the 17th time on a Sunday afternoon.
Do you know what it reminds me of is The Graduate.
Love The Graduate.
The movie changed the country, but the book was like unknown because
Charles
Webb was called The Graduate. He wrote it, it just wallowed for years, and then it made it into a movie, and Nichols made it a great movie.
Let me just tell you, one of the most painful things, other than seeing a movie of a great book, a book you loved, done poorly, is to see a movie you loved to death and see it 25 years later and realize, oh my God, does this not work anymore? I waited for him to say plastics, and it's painful to this moment. In any case, let's go to Brandon. You're in Nashua, New Hampshire. You're not at all. You are in.
I do.
You're in. Well, I'm glad to hear you. I'll try again. You're in Nashua.
That stupid jagged edge thing that you
were
raving about.
I made you watch once. I know that was hard. Okay, fine, Marjorie.
For
move
years
on.
That I watched.
It was horrible. It was dated.
Beyond.
Fine. Fine. Let's move on. Let's go to Nashua, New Hampshire. Brandon, you're on with Garen Daly. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, guys. Love the show.
Thank you.
Big, one of my favorites of all time was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Really?
Didn't see
Never
it, didn't
saw
read it.
It.
I thought
I loved it because you got Martin Freeman playing Arthur Dent, also known as playing Bilbo recently in the new Lord of the Rings movies. You have as playing the voice of Marvin's Alan Rickman. You have Stephen Fry as the guide's voice and the narrator for the movie. It just melded perfectly together.
And, well, the only thing that I really liked about it was Zoe, a very young Zoe Deschanel, was one of the people in that film as well.
Hey, Brandon, if you didn't mention, when you mentioned Martin Freeman, you didn't mention Fargo, which ended last night, you are missing out on one of the great works of a great actor ever. Check it out. Brandon, thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8970. Some writers write, and William Goldman is one I could think of, right, by the way, who you got a sense, I don't know this to be the case, Marathon Man, for example. I mean, you got a sense that he was writing the book for it to be a movie, you know?
Right. Again, some of the writers are very, very good. I tell you, one of the writers that I like, not only Goldman, but Patricia Highsmith. Mm. When her books are being converted, and she's now coming back into favor. There are three movies being produced right now or in the pipe with Patricia Highsmith. She did Strangers on a Train, The American Friend, Purple Noon, The Talented Mr. Ripley. So she's another one of those people.
You know another guy who clearly wrote everything he wrote purely for to be made in a movie? Arthur Conan Doyle. Wouldn't you agree? He's sitting down saying to himself, I think Benedict Cumberbatch can really, and Freeman can really do this.
By the way, the best Sherlock Holmes ever. Arthur Conan Doyle books have been converted into movies?
How many?
220.
You weren't even prepared for this. Is that true?
I was.
I didn't tell you.
I actually sat down and found a website that had the top authors converted into film, and Shakespeare is number one at 831.
Oh, tell us more. Who was on the top five?
Second one you will never guess. This one blew me away.
Give us a hint.
Russian.
Anna Karenina.
Chekhov. Chekhov has 320 movies made into films. Dickens, 300. Dumas, 243. Poe, 240.
Wow.
Brothers Grimm, 212. And my Edgar Wallace, 214. The guy was like,
wow.
It's unbelievable.
Well, those must have been before our time, Jim.
Here's some
good ones.
What's that?
From Stephen. Slaughterhouse-Five.
That's a good one.
Of Mice and Men. Cider House Rules. That was by John Irving.
Cider House Rules is a fabulous book, and it is a really good movie.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
And then the
How about Garp?
Best American novel ever, and great movie, Grapes of Wrath.
Stop on John Irving for a second. What did people think of The World According to Garp? One of the great books.
That was such a weirdo book.
It was also such a weirdo movie. But Robin Williams is pretty terrific in that.
Issues.
Robin Williams is good in, but I just didn't think it held together very well. Yeah. I think it didn't have the arc. I mean, then it's Catch 22.
Yeah,
that was a big book.
That was really good.
Let's see.
What you're thinking? Let's take a call.
Here we got some. The Road by Cormac McCarthy. I didn't see that.
Yeah, that's good.
The Mist by Stephen King.
Speaking of Stephen King, you know what's what? Marjorie, I asked a question this morning. One of my favorite movies, I don't know if it's a great movie or not, one of my favorite movies, and I think most people feel this way, is Shawshank Redemption.
Great.
Almost nobody knows. I believe it was a novella. I don't even think it was a full deal. Written by Stephen King.
Think about it. Stand By Me, the same thing.
Stand By Me is amazing. I forgot about that.
That was written by Stephen King.
Yes, it was.
Yes.
You're kidding.
I love that movie.
That seems very un-Stephen King-like.
I've said it three times. This time I mean it. Let's take a phone call.
Let's go ahead
to Julia in Arlington. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Julia.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Great, thank you.
My favorite adaptation is James and the Giant Peach.
Oh, you're right. That was great.
It did really well.
What else?
And my least favorite is The Hobbit.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a good one. Garen Daly, what's the morning line on how that transferred?
And The Hobbit, I think what we're talking about is, again, a problem with Hollywood. They wanted to make it into three installments so they could make billions of dollars. And so they kind of stretched it out.
Yeah.
And you can feel like it's padded. You feel like there's no flow to it. And at the same time, we're not as enthralled with the wonderful special effects that were in Lord of the Rings. So as good as Lord of the Rings was as an adaptation, This is a little lacking.
Those gruesome battle scenes in Lord of the Rings. My kids watch those over and over. Sometimes Hollywood
takes a couple times to like try and get it right. For instance, you take the Maltese Falcon, Dashiell Hammett. Mm-hmm. They made that three times in one decade until they got it right. They made it in 1931. They made it in 1936 as Satan Meets a Lady. I think that's the name of it. And then again in 1941 with John Huston,
wow,
which has got that classic ending line from Humphrey Bogart. And I think we have it on a clip.
Harry, what is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Does that make you melt? I didn't know we had that. That holds up.
Doesn't that hold up?
That is a great line. Yeah. That is a great line. You know what was a short story that was made into a great movie? Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Actually, that's another really good
Truman Capote.
I want her to say it. Who was that?
Truman Capote.
Audrey Hepburn.
That's right. And I guess we're going to put Marilyn Monroe in that initially and change their mind.
I think they made a good decision.
Yeah, they did.
And that's an interesting thing. Having the right cast is an important part of making these adaptations, because what people see in their mind and what they're bringing to the screen is an important part.
Yeah, that was a terrific movie. It's an old movie, but if you haven't seen it, I think that holds up. Jim, what do you think?
I don't know, but can I say one thing here?
The Jagged Edge.
I'll say enough already with The Jagged Edge. It was great at the time. It wasn't so great when I forced you to see it 20 years later. Let me just say one thing. Every time we have a food person in here, Marjorie says on the air, I'm so hungry now, I can't see straight. Every time you're here, Garen, I'm ready to run out of this studio into a megaplex and watch through the weekend. It is so terrific. Garen, it is great to see you.
Oh, it is such fun to see you. Garen Daly is a film critic and the producer of the upcoming film, The Orson Welles Complex. Thanks, as always, for being here, Garen. It's such fun. Before we wrap up, we're going to continue our conversation about books on film with writer Bernie Avishai. He joined us last year to talk about his book, Promiscuous, Portnoy's Complaint and Our Doomed Pursuit of Happiness. During the conversation, we ended up talking about all of the Philip Roth films that were turned into movies. You know, you just mentioned Philip Roth's real-life therapist. I wonder what he thought of Portnoy's Complaint, because many people could assume it was a satire of the real-life therapist.
Yeah, well, there's a kind of sad story there, too, because what Kleinschmidt did was publish an article in a psychoanalytic journal in which he revealed things in Philip's story in this article, which then appeared in Portnoy's Complaint, so that everybody knew, in a way, who this therapist was really talking about. I mean, he tried to disguise Philip. Instead of being like a Northeastern novelist, it was a Southern playwright or something like that. But then all the little vignettes that came out in Portnoy's Complaint were revealed in this psychoanalytic journal. And Philip was tremendously chagrined by this. And in fact, when he wrote My Life as a Man, I mean, everything is material for Philip when it comes to these things. When he wrote My Life as a Man, he gives us this whole interaction between the therapist and the novelist over the therapist revealing all this stuff in a psychoanalytic journal.
What did you think of Portnoy's Complaint? Did you read it in 69?
Oh, sure.
Did you read it? What did you think of it in 69? Not now. What did you think of it then?
Oh, I thought, oh my God, I could be so much more cool than I am. you know, I mean, like Philip, I was a nice Jewish boy. I was kind of square. You know, I felt that he had been reading my mind. But, you know, other people like Jim Carroll and others who are not Jewish boys but nice boys felt the same thing. You know, this was a book that I think had a tremendous effect on people precisely because it felt so true and complicated, you know.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, the male identification with this, and in some case the female almost horror with this. I mean, I was sort of horrified, but you know, I was young and I didn't have any brothers. So, I mean, this is like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. But let me ask you something, too. You talk about being a nice Jewish boy, nice Jewish family, all that kind of stuff. Philip Roth took a lot of grief from the Jewish community for not only this, but for, you know, Goodbye Columbus and other things. So, and you think that was also unfair, that he was not trying to satirize, you know, the stereotypical domineering mother, weak father, Jewish family.
By the way, before you answer, I remember forums at my synagogue in Philadelphia, the sole focus of which was to excoriate Roth and the book for its portrayal of Jews in America.
Yeah. Well, the famous Gershom Sholem said, you know, Gershom Sholem, the historian at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, said, you know, what could be more horrible than for us to reveal the lust of a Jewish man for a Gentile woman in this way. And, you know, when the next, I mean, he didn't quite put it this way, but when the next Holocaust comes, we'll have started it here, you know, with this book. And I think quite the reverse happened. I think what happened was, you know, Portnoy became a kind of ticket getting punched by Jews into the mainstream of American American life. It was, you know, oh, Jews are like the rest of us. Isn't that a relief? You know, yeah. it was that kind of a sense of exhilaration that you know, Jews also lust, Jews also masturbate, Jews also
they do
dissemble. Yes.
Well, hey, I want to play you a clip from Portnoy's complaint. Can we hear that for a second, then ask you a question? Here it is.
Why don't you tell me to change my clothes to some alley cat or a tree, because at least they exist?
If your mother was here now, if she wasn't sick in the hospital with her agony. One day a year, you ask him to do something for you. He's too big for it. He's too brilliant for it.
You're the ignorant one.
How does he feel about the film? First of all, Goodbye Columbus is one of my all-time movies ever. I've probably seen it a dozen times. How does he feel about Portnoy's complaint?
It was the worst film ever made.
Does he feel that way, or you feel
absolutely.
That way?
Absolutely. It was the worst film ever made.
And does he give – I'm embarrassed that I don't know. What sort of independence does he give up when someone buys the rights to his film? Obviously, he gives up plenty, yes?
A lot.
Okay, so I'll tell you a story about Patrimony. He sold Patrimony to CBS. And he told me that he wasn't sure whether he should do this. You know, Patrimony is the story of his father's death. And he said he went out to the graveyard where his father was buried. And he said, you know, he said, Bernie, I talked to my father. And he said, take the money. So he took the money. And then CBS said, you know, we really want to have creative control here. But... you know, maybe instead of it being a father who dies, maybe it should be a mother.
Oh, gosh.
And instead of it being a Jewish guy, maybe we'll make him a Gentile, so it'll have, you know, a bigger swath of American mainstream. And instead of the father dying, the mother lives.
Oh my God! Well, how about
they never made it?
How about Goodbye Columbus? I mean, lots of people love that movie. I thought that with Richard Benjamin. It was Ally McGraw.
He liked that film.
Yeah, that was a good one. That was
but
a good one.
They haven't made a lot of films of Phillips' books. He did. There was a rather good film made of the Ghostwriter.
Never saw that.
With his ex Claire Bloom, so he doesn't watch it anymore, but. But the film made of the human stain, he didn't think much of.
And when's the last time you saw him?
2 days ago.
How is he at 80?
He was exhilarated from the party. He felt that the people who came to celebrate him had worked really hard to prepare very beautiful little essays, not just about his work, but about the meaning of literature. It was just, you know, Edna O'Brien came and Jonathan Lethem. And
is he retired?
He's retired. He's not.
I was going to ask you why. He just said no more writing. That's it.
Look, writing a book is hard. You know, when you're 80 years old, you have to leave yourself a sentence the night before and sort of think of it overnight and pick it up in the morning, and you have to do that for a year. There's a time to sort of hang him up.
Yeah.
And I think he's done that really intelligently.
But staying on that for a second, is he retired then because he wants to be or because he has to be? Is that – what are you saying, Bernie?
He's retired because he wants to be. He has a wonderful biographer now, Blake Bailey, who's doing a biography of his not just of his life, but of his work. And he's spending a lot of time helping Blake understand the various books and the turns in his life that explain the books. He tells me, you know, I used to think only about, women and prizes. Now I think about my next nap. And he loves it. He loves it. He said the Pope called him a couple of days ago to say, isn't it great? Isn't it great? Isn't that great? Yeah, it's great. We don't do nothing. We don't explain nothing. We don't have to make notes after every conversation. You know, he's happy.
Well, do you think Philip Roth has gotten his due in the literary world? I mean, I know Portnoy's complaint is in a lot of these lists. You see Time Magazine and so forth.
Right.
It's up there in the best
right.
novels
right.
of the 21st century and stuff,
right.
or 20th century. Do you think he's gotten his due?
I think he is now. I think, you know, he's almost never introduced without being introduced as America's greatest living author. But, you know, authors die, and for many of them, their work dies with them. I don't think that'll happen with Philip Roth. I think that his work is sort of like the work of Dickens. It doesn't just chronicle our time, but it chronicles a whole human life. From childhood through to the anticipation and dread of the oblivion of death. And he writes, not all of his books have been great, but I would say a half dozen are truly great and punctuate a whole human life. And the best ones are written in his blood. I mean, he's that kind of author. He writes with his blood, and people know it and love him for it. I mean, the truth is, if I weren't his friend, I'd still consider him one of my best friends,
which
even if I never even knew him.
If I can ask you about that, when you're sitting with Philip Roth, and I always wonder this when someone's friends with someone who is greatness, when you're sitting there just having a conversation with Philip Roth, do you ever step back and realize that you're in the presence of someone who, as you said, is recognized as maybe the greatest writer of his generation? You know what I mean?
Well, sure, to some extent. Of course, there's a kind of pride I take in having friends who have distinguished lives. I think everybody who's human takes pride in that. But the truth is, I got to know him in some pretty dark days when he didn't really feel like he was going to come back. And, you know, we've been close friends for 30 years. And if you go back 30 years ago, he had not really produced the great books of his latter career. So, you know, the truth is I love him. I just pull for him. I'm so proud of him. I'm really proud of him. I feel like he's a man who deserves the love that people have for him, and I sure have it.
You know, I just wonder, can you think of the kind of the people you think of chronicling Jewish life, if whether he was doing that or not? It's Philip Roth, and the next person that comes to mind in film, of course, is Woody Allen.
Yeah.
What does Philip Roth think of Woody Allen? The scene you just played from Portnoy's Complaint reminds me so much of the scene with Woody Allen asking his father the meaning of life, and the father says, "How the hell do I know? I can't even find a can opener," or something like that. You know what I mean? What does he think of him? Not much.
I don't think I like the answer
I don't think I can. I don't want to speak for him.
Okay.
Let's just say he's been a friend of Mia Farrow.
Oh, well,
that's
good
a very good
him.
Answer, Bernie
good
Abishai.
Good for him after all his shenanigans. Good for him.
Hey, Bernie Abishai, your latest book, Promiscuous, Portnoy's Complaint, and Our Doomed Pursuit of Happiness. Good luck with it, Bernie. Thanks so much.
Thank
for
you.
Great
Thank
you,
you very much. And congratulations for such a great book on the great Philip Roth. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our production crew includes Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and Devin Karambalis. Our engineers are John Parker and Alan Mattis. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio.